Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of India. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. Welcome to the Voice of Indie podcast, episode number 55. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me over there in the corner is Mr. Stephen Jeeves. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing all right. Apparently, it's Wednesday already?
It's Wednesday already.
Wednesday.
Yeah,
already.
Now before we get started here, I would like to let everybody know that one of our loyal listeners, Lisa Greenho, that's Verwayne Greenho's wife, she's having some health issues. So those of you who are so inclined, she could use your prayers. I'm inclined, so I've added her to my prayers, but it's a serious thing. I'm not going to go into detail, but we're thinking about Lisa and Verwayne Greenho tonight, so keep them in your prayers.
Yes, we wish both of them the very best. It's going to be a tough, challenging couple of weeks for them and maybe even beyond. But hang in there. We're all pulling for you and sending you our best.
Yeah. All right. So you just saw an old friend of yours for the third time, Stephen.
Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton. Yeah.
So how is Billy Bob these days?
He's looking skinny. Every time I see him, he gets a little bit skinnier, but he's still kind of a crazy old coot. His band, the Boxmasters, played about an hour from where I live down here, and it's become a tradition. Every time he comes around, I go see him and then hang out afterwards backstage and get to meet him, take a picture with him. This time he was having a lot of fun. He was telling stories. He's got a 6-piece band, and he's telling stories about how they're all living in the old monkey's house out in Bellfire, California, and doing each other's hair and stuff like that. He's just a hoot. But it was a great concert, a lot of fun. Got one tomorrow night. Genesis tribute band Abacab is going to be in Woodstock, Georgia, and I will be there with a friend of mine, soaking all of that up. And then the following night in Center, Alabama, we've got a Steely Dan tribute band called Hey 19 coming. So I got a musical week planned.
Yeah, you know, for those of you who don't understand what a tribute band is, these are really good bands that do certain acts, and they'll do, you know, albums from the bands and whatnot. And these guys, most of these tribute bands are excellent. It's not like a bar band doing covers. These people are dedicated. Oftentimes they'll dress the part. They'll, you know, if there are costumes, they put the costumes on. If they do an album, they'll do it in order, and they're just really cool. So these are a lot of these bands you're not going to see again, like Led Zeppelin or the Beatles. And this is your chance to kind of get a vibe for what they would have been like live.
Yeah, like next month, my co-host Beam Weeks will be down here in Alabama visiting, and we're going to see a couple of Black Jacket Symphony Pink Floyd tribute concerts, which should be excellent too. And
yeah.
I remember last year I took a young lady friend of mine to see a Pink Floyd tribute concert. I believe this one was Brit Floyd, which is very, very popular, very well known around the world.
I've seen them on PBS.
And she was just shocked. She thought I was taking her to see like a bar band doing the covers and didn't realize that this is, you know, all the lights, the stage show, everything as if you were going to a Pink Floyd concert. Even, you know, the giant props, the big pig that comes out, the airplane, and you know, all of that kind of stuff, too. It was like seeing a concert, but it just wasn't the original Pink Floyd members up there doing the performance. And she said that she'd been arguing with a friend of hers earlier in the day about, well, you know, this is it. That's not the real thing. That doesn't count. Why you go see something like that? And it's like, well, why do you go see Beethoven's Ninth performed by your local symphony? He ain't around anymore. But, you know, he wrote those songs with their performance for the public in mind. And now hundreds of years later, people are recreating the shows that Beethoven wrote and putting them on for new generations. Why can't we do that with Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or some of the great classic rock acts of our age, which are no longer out there able to do it? Sometimes members have died or they've broken up or it's just not going to happen. So I can't go see Pink Floyd next month when my friend comes down here to visit, but we can sure see Black Jacket Symphony put on one hell of a show.
And hey, if people will pay money to see this thing that calls itself Lynyrd Skynyrd today, it's not Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's
no.
Basically the same thing. It's a tribute band, but they've got one guy left in the band, Gary Rossington, and he's having heart issues, so he's not even on the tour right now. So you're getting, that's a cover band, but people will still line up for that. I want to throw this in here. Verwayne Greenhoe, he said, on behalf of my wife, we appreciate your well wishes. Well, we're glad that you're out there, Verwayne, but definitely keep us up to date on what's going on.
Yeah, we're hanging in there with you. Yeah, these another thing to consider, too, with these tribute acts is the cost. Now, see, Genesis is one of my all-time favorite bands. I used to go see them way back in when Peter Gabriel was the lead singer, and there would only be like 150, 200 people in the entire auditorium, and nobody knew who they were. And now Genesis is coming to Detroit in November, and in order to get a pair of tickets that I could afford, I had to get lower bowl in the back of the auditorium, two tickets for $750. Now, the Abacab concert that I'm going to tomorrow night, where they're going to play a whole lot of those same songs, it just won't be my original Genesis members, but it's going to be a fun show. Those are $40 a seat. That's a little bit of a difference. And after a while, when you get to be my age and you can't quite see as clearly as you could anyway, they start to look like those real Genesis members up there when you can save that kind of money.
Okay.
So anyway, we got a book out this week called Hello Chattanooga. We've been talking about this for about 4, 5, 6 weeks now. 710 pages long with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of color and black and white pictures. This is by David Carroll, who's the NBC affiliate news anchor in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He's a media personality, been known far and wide, especially around the Chattanooga area for many decades. Very popular guy. He's got a website and a newspaper column and some other stuff that he does too, plus some other books, including Volunteer Bama Dog that we published. So, Hello Chattanooga. It's out there now. There might be still a few places where, you know, the cover's not showing yet or whatever as it continues to populate, but you can place your pre-order and the book will be released next month. And that's Hello Chattanooga. And Beam has some opinions about the index in that book, which is quite pretty.
Yeah, that was a lot of hard work there, indexing a book of this magnitude. It's a really cool book. Like I said before, I've said in previous weeks, if you're a fan of anything, it's in there. So you'll want to check it out. Music, sports, politics, old vaudevillian actors and actresses, just a lot of really cool stuff. And we do have a brand new video for it on the Fresh Ink Group YouTube channel. So.
Yeah.
Get over there, check it out. Hit that like button on the video. Hit the subscribe button if you're not already subscribed, and help us grow this this channel and this ship that we're calling Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah, as we were getting ready to make that video too, we're thinking, okay, now we're going to have to hire somebody to do the voiceover for a news anchor. I wonder who we could get to do that. And then you know, it occurred to us, maybe David could do it himself. So you get to hear David talk when you go check out that video too.
Yes, indeed.
Now, another thing that came up this week is we had somebody decide to get real serious about our business practices and go over to the Better Business Bureau and start filing things. And that's our member, Jill Clark. She totally surprised us this week by giving us a 5-star rating at the Better Business Bureau website. So thank you, Jill. Nobody has ever done that for us before, and I would not dissuade anybody else from ever wanting to do something like that if they, you know, they ever take a notion.
Yeah. Okay, we also have a new contest, the Fresh Ink Group Short Story Contest. We've got a new video for that over there on the YouTube channel. And if you haven't sent in any short stories yet, now's your time. Go over to the Fresh Ink Group website, freshinkgroup.com, and search out that contest page, hit it up, and just follow along and Get your short stories then, and if you want to know what it's all about, go over to the YouTube channel, check out the new video for that as well. Again,
and
hit that like button.
Yes, like. We also have a new audiobook that's out this week, Operation Arctic Sting, book 3 of a Mac McDowell Mission series by Robert G. Willis-Croft is now out in audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Audible, Amazon, ACX, wherever you get your audiobooks, and get yourself a copy of that. This is the one that's got a cool painting of an orca whale and a couple of divers on the front. And notice that the whale's got a little bite out of his fin.
Got a chunk taken out of his fin.
Got a chunk taken out, and that's important for the story. So at any rate, that's the Operation Arctic Sting, a Mac McDowell Mission audiobook, now on sale. Get out there and get your copy. Make sure you post a review from wherever you bought it. Give it that, you know, 5 stars and say good things. Keep in mind, too, that this is a Fresh Ink Group production. And when we put out audiobooks, we add music, sound effects, scratch and sniff, anything that we can think to add in there and make it just a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, and this was a lot of fun doing this audiobook. We've done several other audiobooks for Robert Willis-Croft as well. And it's always an adventure because he's quite knowledgeable about this and he knows the sounds that he's looking for. So a lot of times he'll go and find the sound effects for us himself, and you learn different things. The speaker communications in there. There's a Gertrude. There's what are some of the other ones? There's like 3 or 4 different ones. There's a diver talk. So when they're talking to the divers, there's, you know, we have to put a special effect on the voice of the diver as he's speaking back. And just a lot of really cool stuff. Then you've got the sound effects for the sub itself when it's diving. There's a creaking sound in the subs when they're going under all that water pressure. And that's kind of cool. And we've got that in there. We've just a lot of really cool stuff. It's fun doing those kind of books.
Barbara Johnson, who goes under the author name B.A. Johnson, we published her book a couple of months ago called Sassy Discovers the AME Church, which is a children's book that includes some really cool artwork in it. Miss Johnson has made it her mission to try to get that book into libraries all across the country and around the world as well. And she started out having to learn how that works, that libraries tend to order from the distributor Baker and Taylor, which Fresh Ink Group does use. So any of our authors out there or any of you indie authors who even aren't members of ours but interested in learning how to do more and more for yourself, make sure that when you talk to libraries and urge them to order it, that they do have access to the Baker and Taylor base, if not the Ingram base and some of the others as well, and push them, you know, be aggressive and encourage them to get the books out there on the shelves. And so far, Ms. Johnson's efforts have been paying off. In today's newsletter, you'll see a couple of photos even of the Huntsville, Alabama library system displaying her book now. So congratulations, Barbara. We're glad to see you out there really working at this and putting the effort into making sure that you can share your book with the world. And libraries are a good way to do that.
Yay, Barbara. All right, listeners, as you heard a little while ago, I already read a comment on Twitter. If you would like to be a participant in tonight's episode with tonight's guest, you can call in or you can send us a message on Twitter, and here's how you do this.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest, or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
There you go. So
now we do have a tweet from Dr. Helen Burrell. She says, Gabriel Constance is a gifted, multifaceted creator of books and films and of improving people's lives through his therapeutic work. Looks like I have lots of great readings by Dr. Constance to look forward to. Excellent comment. Thank you, Helen.
All right. I see Verwayne Greenhoe says Amazon says that Hello Chattanooga will be released as an ebook on September 25th.
Right. Now, keep in mind, you can pre-order. And what we're doing with Fresh Ink Group releases now is putting anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks of pre-release sale time in there, which gives us plenty of time to solve problems. And as time goes by, problems I have been mushrooming in terms of listings and metadata and things like that. It gives us some time to to solve the problems and do some extra promotion. But then when all of those books get recorded as a sale on the release date, then you got a whole bunch of sales all at once too, which helps drive up your sales ranking at places like Amazon. So in a case like this, if we say, hey, the book's out, get out there and order it, it doesn't mean necessarily that it's released. It just means you can place your order. And in this case, for Wayne's pointed out, September 25th is the release date. I knew it was sometime late September. I just wasn't sure of the date. So thanks for the note, Verwayne.
Okay.
Now,
so you want to intro our guest?
I think that might be a good idea. Today, we have Gabriel Constance. Gabriel Constance has written for numerous magazines, newspapers, and journals throughout North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia, has 14 books published in the U.S., and continues to write fiction, nonfiction, and screenplays. His latest work of nonfiction is A Brave Year, 52 Weeks Being Mindful. Dr. Constance has worked as a trauma counselor in a variety of situations and environments, most notably with local and international nonprofit organizations such as hospice, the coroner's office, hospitals, state prisons, the Center for Street Children, and the Ihangani Project, both in Rwanda. His classes on grief, loss, hope, and transformation can be found at the Figley Institute and Quantum Continuing Education online. Gabriel's favorite writers include, and I had to point out to him yesterday that my name was missing from this list. It must be a typo. Gabriel's favorite writers include Dina Metzger, Isabel Allende, I'm going to second that one, Wallace Stegner, Toni Morrison, yeah, Bell Hooks, Zora Neale Hurston, I've never heard of, Dave Eggers, man, we definitely like us some Dave Eggers, don't we, Beam? Ann Petrie, Carlos Ruiz Zafon, Alice Walker, Barbara Kingsolver. Let's pause for a minute while I bow down in respect to Barbara.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joan Tewksbury, and of course, James Baldwin, the great James Baldwin. Yeah, Barbara Kingsolver. Anytime you mention her, Poisonwood Bible.
My all-time favorite book.
Easily one of my top 10 all-time favorites. Yeah, easily. But anyway, that's Gabriel Constance. Welcome, Gabriel.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you inviting me to the show, and you just made me want to go back and start reading all those books again and reading Barbara. And I actually am reading another James Baldwin short story collection right now. And it's just so amazingly good and has stayed with the time and, you know, holds true just and probably always will. It's just, I love different writers, and that's why one reason I like your show so much is that you have such a diverse group of people on that have written all kinds of material from all walks of life about everything under the sun. So
Cool. Have you read the Poisonwood Bible, which both of us just raved about?
I have. It's been a long time, but I did, and I remember at first it took me a while to get into it. And then once about halfway through, when I started realizing who was who and what was going on, I couldn't stop reading it then. You know,
oh,
it was
brilliant.
So good.
For those who have never read that book, Barbara Kingsolver, each chapter is a different point of view. It's a mother and four daughters, actually five daughters. There's the twins, mm-hmm. the older. No, it is four daughters, I think. But anyway, each of the female characters has the point of view of each different chapter. So you're getting their personalities, and she was just brilliant in writing those personalities. The only one that doesn't have his own point of view is the father, which is kind of interesting. But just a brilliantly written, I thought.
Yeah, and each of those points of view, which alternate between the chapters, is also narrated by the character. So it's narrated in the first person, hearing that person actually speak. And one of them is I think it's a teenage girl or slightly preteen who's special needs. And the way she sees the world and describes things and interprets things, it's brilliant point of view writing. But at any rate, we're not here to talk about Barbara Kingsolver.
We'll do that when we have her on the show.
Yeah. I also got to listen to a couple of her audiobooks that she narrated herself. So any of you who are interested in discovering Barbara Kingsolver, she's got that Appalachian, just that lilting kind of, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but she's fun to listen to, and she certainly knows her material.
So, Gabriel, where are you from?
We're in Santa Cruz, California, which is the Bay Area, Northern California. And I grew up in Redding, which is a small town in Northern California, which is mostly with a lumber mill and sort of a gateway to recreational areas, mountains on all the different sides of it. It was at the very top of the valley there.
Wow.
And I lived there until I was like, so how long was I? Until I was around 21 or so. And then I moved down to where I live now. And it's been here ever since. So it was quite a contrast from that smaller town to down here. The town I live in is just about the same population, but just poultry-wise, diversity-wise, it's very, very different. So.
Okay. So you grew up where you grew up in childhood. Obviously, you're a writer now and quite accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a reader and a writer as a child, or is this something that came along later on?
No, I always liked reading, but I remember especially getting into writing in high school, and I was started writing and different stories and more journalistic stories about things that were going on. And then I started an alternative newspaper in the high school to the school paper and wrote things about, and had other friends write articles about, and I was the editor of it, about war and peace and sex and birth control and coming of age and all kinds of things like that, which weren't talked about in the school paper at all, about different issues that a lot of high school students were dealing with then. And I remember the school principal, they called and were going to have me arrested for handing it out. But when the lawyer came for the school district, they said, well, you really can't do that because he's only giving them out during breaks and lunch times, and he has a right to do it. So luckily I didn't go to jail for my writing. And ever since then I've continued writing. There was a period of time where I didn't write much at all. And then, with my Lovejoy partner, Audrey, who've been together about 33 years, now, she, not long after we got together, about a year or so afterwards, she had reminded me about the writing I'd done and really encouraged me to start writing again. And so that's when I really began writing a lot more and getting some short stories published and my first book published around then. That was mine was 32, 33 years ago. I don't remember. I can't count that fast. But, so since then, I've been writing pretty consistently.
I find that fascinating, writing an alternate newspaper to your school newspaper. That's rebellious.
Yeah, I did that.
That's
I
cool.
did that in junior high. Wound up,
I wrote for the
having to have a meeting with the entire school board.
I just wrote for the straight school newspaper. I didn't even think about, you know, something alternative, which would have been cool.
Yeah. Well, I worked on the school paper too. That's where I was the photographer for the school paper, and actually, the dark room led out into the hallway. And those were in days when many listeners might not know, but you had to actually use all these developers to have pictures come to be. They weren't digitalized.
Yeah.
And I remember a number of times the class for the school paper that I had would be right around the lunch hours. And all the lunch breaks were like a half-hour break for each, and there were three different breaks. So I would go out to Times, develop a picture, and then I'd go out the other door. And I was able to go to two or three lunches a day at Times without And without anybody knowing, I wasn't in class. So.
All right, Steven, you want to take the next one?
Yeah, why don't we play a commercial? Because we're already 24 minutes in here. You want to play the Hello Chattanooga?
Sure.
Hello Chattanooga, famous people who have visited the Tennessee Valley, features photos, stories, and complete listings of the entertainers, athletes, political leaders, and others who visited the area since 1900. Chattanooga has attracted some of the best-known celebrities in the world, thanks to our city's historic venues, beautiful scenery, and powerful people. Hello Chattanooga features hundreds of restored photos, behind-the-scenes stories, and thousands of fully indexed entries spanning more than 700 pages. I'm David Carroll. I've worked in Chattanooga television and radio for more than 40 years. I also write a weekly newspaper column and have written two other books, Chattanooga Radio and Television, A Photo History of Chattanooga Media, and Volunteer Bama Dog, A TV Guy's Love Letter to the South, a collection of my most popular stories. Hello Chattanooga is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in a keepsake, jacketed, hardcover edition with full-color interior printing, softcover with black and white photos, and all-color ebook formats worldwide. Take a trip back in time, enjoy great memories, and maybe even settle an argument as you learn the dates and places that your favorite star, athlete, or president visited the Chattanooga area.
Cool. Yeah, and you don't have to be from the Chattanooga area to enjoy this book, I'm telling you. If you're a fan of music,
from presidents
anything.
To rock stars to everybody in that, and the stories and the list, it's just really, really cool. And Verwayne Greenhoe over on Twitter mentioned that he did order his copy of Hello Chattanooga, famous people who have visited the Tennessee Valley, to be auto-delivered wirelessly to his Kindle on September 25th. So let's all be like Verwayne. Get out there and order our copies. It's a fantastic book. We're looking forward to getting some feedback from readers out there.
Indeed.
So tell us about your family, Gabriel. You've mentioned that you've been with your wife for 32, 33 years, although she's probably noticed you didn't know exactly how long that was.
Yeah.
You got kids, siblings, famous relatives, people in prison. What's going on with your family?
Well, I don't know any Billy Bob Thornton, but I do. I had a one-night date with Joan Baez.
Ooh.
Who
sweet.
Was, and when I mean a one-night date, I meant I stayed out behind where she was having a concert and talked to her manager for a long time till I got her to come outside so I could get my picture taken with her. And so that lasted about 5 minutes. She said it was really cold out and had to go back in. So that was the end of our date. But other than that, we've got... five children, three by way of birth and two by way of adoption, and all of our kids are adults now, and four fantastic grandkids, and they all live a variety of places, some in Santa Cruz or close to Santa Cruz, some up in Portland, Oregon, others up in Seattle, Washington. And sisters, I got one first sister and then a whole lot of foster sisters. Some still in touch with and others not. So
are there other writers in the family? Like are any of your kids showing an interest in following Dad's footsteps?
Well, a couple, actually about four of the kids are really good writers. They're really good. They write in different ways in different times than I've actually said a number of times to them that they should do more writing, but it's not something that any of them really want to do that consistently or full time, but they're very good. But some are, I thought in some ways better than the way I write. And, but anyway, I wouldn't ever, you know, encourage people to write, but I never would want to make somebody write at all. So yeah, one owns his own business, a tea room up in Portland, like a English high tea, but Since it's in Portland, it's very quirky and it's not the traditional. It's a traditional high tea with all the trays and all that kind of stuff, but it's called Lovejoy's Tea Room of Portland, and it's wonderful. Him and his partner are doing really well, and our other daughter in Seattle is a physician, and she's doing well, and another daughter teaches and a special ed teacher and was especially close by, and her wife are down in Carmel with the two of the kids, and her wife is a wedding planner at a very famous national wedding place where people come from all over the place to have weddings. And our other son was up in Portland, and he works in education as well with a group called iMentor, which is based out of high school and based out of New York, and they work with high school students, mentoring students all across the country. And then we have another son that lives here in town, and he's lives on his own, has his own apartment, is really a really great with he's a gamer. He's really into games, and that's his thing. Games and going for walks. So.
Well, as a retired drama counselor, then obviously you spend a lot of your time writing nonfiction and fiction and working on screenplays. And I noticed you were executive producer on the last Conception. So that means you're also spending a lot of time, you know, making phone calls, talking to people, trying to worry about getting money together and putting a project together and everything. What other kind of stuff do you do? I mean, do you raise daffodils? Are you a frog collector? How do you spend your time?
How did you know I'm a frog collector and I keep them under the daffodil? No, one of the things I really, I never was in the past, but in the last 10 years, really gotten into doing gardening and stuff. But most lately, for the last 2-3 years, I've really enjoyed playing the ukulele and singing.
Wow.
And playing the ukulele, and started a little group here once a week for just people in the neighborhood to get together and play ukulele. So there's about 4 to 6 of us that meet every week, and everybody brings a new song each week, and then we go over all the ones we have already. So we have quite a few now, and do quite a variety from the 20s, 30s, through 50s and 60s and present day and Hawaiian and all kind of traditional and country and all different kinds of music. And it's a lot of fun. It's met some wonderful people, and we've gotten to become really good friends. And sort of like when you're with a group of people for a long time, you sit and talk about everything, you know, everything else under the sun, not just play music. So that's been really enjoyable as well.
Yeah, and ukulele, terrific. That's really making a big comeback. I noticed that it's even in like pop music that the kids are listening to today. There's a lot of ukulele in there. It's, you know, it's an easier instrument to learn to play. So I think that's where a lot of them are picking it up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I think actually in the last 20 years, it's really come back. And where we live and in Hawaii, it's huge. I think here they almost broke the record for the most ukuleles playing one song continuously at one time for the Guinness Book of World Records. I think they're only a short period of time. But that's how many ukuleles, and I started collecting ukuleles, and they've been around since the 20s and 30s. And I found out actually fairly recently that George Harrison was a huge fan of ukuleles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he would buy them and give them to friends, and he would invite her at Clapton and Bob Dylan, all different people over his house. Hey, come on over and let's play some ukulele together. And, you know, some were like, okay, we've been playing this for a couple hours, I got to go. You know, but a lot of them really enjoyed it. Wherever he went, he lived in Hawaii for a while, and he'd go to stores there and buy out a whole bunch of ukuleles and give them to all his friends and say, hey, it's really fun, you should try this. And I think there's only one or two, I think it's only one song of the Beatles, a little ukulele comes in at the end of it. I don't remember which one it is. Other than that, he has a ukulele once or twice on his own albums. But just very, very little, though, yeah.
Yeah, Paul McCartney, I believe it was, did a tribute to George, and he played, I'm thinking it was Something on the ukulele.
I think it was.
To him.
I think you're right. I think it was during the tribute to George Harrison when a whole bunch of people got together, played a lot of music, and he played the ukulele in one song. I think it was something. I think it was, he did it for, with a song Something, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Probably on YouTube.
Yeah, I think ukulele's gotten real big since Slash played that searing lead on Michael Jackson's video, you know.
Yeah.
I've tried playing the lead like for California by the Eagles on the ukulele, and it just doesn't sound the same.
Now we have a Fresh Ink Group member author, Andrew McGregor, who is a bagpipe player, and he's out there doing bagpipe performances in Santa Monica every evening.
Oh, wow.
So maybe we need to get, Stephen King and a couple of other writers too, and call them the Rock Bottom Remainders too, and see what we can do.
Yeah, you know, we got Kanoi Kay. She's a ukulele player.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of people in her family are.
And she, Kanoi Kay just sent us, all of our Fresh Ink Group people, some CDs with Hawaiian music that she put together for us as a thank you for doing such a nice job on her book. So again, thank you for that, Kanoi.
Right.
That was very cool.
Yeah.
Turns out my father really likes one of those too, and he's been sneaking it from me. So Gabriel,
that's
what's
really
your
nice.
What's your process like? I mean, are you one of those Elmore Leonard, I write it on a legal pad kind of people, or you use software? you write in the morning, evening, whenever you feel like it. What's your writing world like?
Well, that's interesting. Usually when I'm writing something, first there's a lot of thinking about it for days, sometimes months, and actually for the next screenplay I do for. Actually, the screenplay I just finished and actually just got accepted, actually, is going to get produced. I just got that this week. That took about, how long, 8 or 9 years of thinking about writing that script. But once I decide to sit down and actually write something, I usually have this similar process that I go through. First, everything in the house. Now that the kids are older, it's easier with nobody else here during the day. It used to be, you know, I'd watch kids, go to school in the evening, or work in the evening, do schoolwork at night after I got home from work, and then get up and be with the kids all day while my ex-wife was at her work when I was with them during the day, and things like that. And the only time I could write would be late at night, which is pretty exhausting. But ever since the kids start getting older, process I usually go through is, first I have to have everything in the house. It's very, what do you call it, OCD or whatever that term is. But I have to have everything done first that I have to have done in the house. I mean, it's like, I have to have the dishes done. Everything's got to be in the right place. If I had to get to water the plants outside, I have to do that first. And I need to get all that done. And then I try to sit down around the same time each day. And then I take about 2 to 4 hours, depending on how much is coming forth at that time. And I write. And I usually do that every day until the first draft of that's done. And it's interesting. For nonfiction, I always just start writing right on the computer and on Microsoft. I don't know why, but I do. I keep getting notes or research or interviews I've done, et cetera, whatever it is for it. But for anything I write for fiction, I sit and take a tablet, a line tablet, not a handheld tablet, and I write in longhand. And I write out whatever the story is in longhand first. And I do the entire story, whether it's a short story, a novel, or a screenplay. I will do it all in longhand first. And I go back and cross out some stuff and do it, but mostly I just write it out as it's coming through, as I'm thinking about it and what happens next. And a couple of books I've outlined ahead of time, but most I just write as I go. And I don't have any set structure in mind until I start writing and just see what happens. And then when I start editing, that's when I start translating or taking everything I wrote on the pad on the computer. And then that's when I start editing it and typing it up on there. And then I go through and edit it on there, you know, over and over and over and over and over and over. So that's, and in the last number of years, actually the last 10 years, pretty much whenever I've written something and I feel it's really done to as much as it's ever done, which is you could have a whole show about when you know it's done or don't know it's done or is it done? Do I need to edit it more? Et cetera. It could go on and on about that. But usually then I have it edited and send it to somebody else to edit and just proofread and edit. I never used to do that, but just for grammar, if nothing else. And then that always makes it so much better. And usually they notice things also that I may not have noticed too.
Yeah, exactly. It's always good to get that second set of eyes on your work because you're so close to it that maybe you don't pick up on certain things.
Absolutely. And it doesn't always have to be an editor, but it's hard sometimes to find a friend or family member that's really objective, that you know is really a good editor also. That's really good at looking at it with an editor's eyes. But some people do have family members or friends that can do that. And that's great if you do. It saves a little money. But but I would really recommend, going to, somewhere like Fresh Ink or, individual editor somewhere or anybody to get it edited. And it doesn't, you can find places where it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. And a lot of people, you get recommendations from people on Twitter. That's where I've gotten a lot of them in the writing community and other writers. And they can let you know who's worked really well and who hasn't, and it has a reasonable rate. So.
Yeah, we had editor Susan Hughes on the show just a week or two ago, and one of the pieces of advice that she gave was also evaluate what your editor's doing. Get a sample of the work and look at it carefully. Don't just decide to give somebody the job and then look the other direction and see what happens. You have to participate and know that the editor is understanding what you're trying to do. Because sometimes an editor will think, well, I'm fixing this thing, and it's like, well, you're fixing something I did on purpose. So the question here is, did I do it on purpose well? Is that what needs fixing or, whatever? So it's a very interactive kind of a process, whereas a lot of people think you just mail it off to an editor and you'll get it back in so many weeks and that's all you have to do. And that's not how it works. So that's good advice.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And I know Susan too. And also D.L. Finn, who you had recently. So,
okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
small world in the indie community.
Yeah,
it is.
You said you've outlined.
Yeah.
You said you've outlined a couple of times. Have you done TV writing or just feature film screenplays?
Just feature film screenplays.
Okay.
I did write a bunch of short plays, and that became a book, and then got a stage company in New York did it. Once or twice to help raise money for to support women with cancer, because the play is called The Goddess of Cancer and Other Plays, and the primary play in it is about story in there is about a woman who is literally cancer incarnated, and different people, different women from all variety of ages and walks of life come to talk to her who have just recently had cancer or have it and are going through treatment, or some that are not treatable. And they come and talk to her as if she's a person and how she's affected them, et cetera. And so that's what this one play is. So this one company there put it on to raise money. And but yeah, mostly feature screenplays. So
yeah, I'm curious about that because way back in the day, we're talking decades ago, I used to do a fair amount of television writing and executive producer of some ongoing TV shows as well. And I found that TV writers tend to be outliners because, you know, you've got that structure. You've got the, I've got 8 minutes here, and then I've got 8 minutes, and then I've got 6 minutes to resolve it, and then 2 minutes to wrap it up. Or whatever, so you have to be really, really tight, almost, you know, drawing boxes or charts or whatever, and putting your little notes in there. It's like, well, we got to have to introduce this in scene two, so that it can be ready in scene three when we need it, and you know, all of that stuff. So, I have never met a TV writer who was not a hardcore outliner, but feature film writers tend to be kind of seat of the pants, go with the flow type. So, I'm kind of not surprised by your answer being kind of in the middle there. But that process is very interesting. And a lot of our writers out there are interested in getting into television or feature film screenplays, especially now with there's such a huge explosion in cable TV, the Netflixes and the Hulus and so many different companies putting money out there and trying to buy content. This is the golden age again. It's time to get out there and start hustling your stuff. So, thanks for sharing that with us. That's a very interesting part of that process.
Yeah, TV writing is a really different thing. I have so much respect for people that write series because they have to storyboard everything. And it just, you have to have everything. So I don't see how they keep track of everything. Huh. You know, some of our favorite series we watched, you know, you just think of that series, The Gambit, The Queen's Gambit, and different series, just almost any series that's really good, really well done, so intricate and so many different characters, so many different things happen and characters and things that come back later that have an effect on what happened with somebody else. And I sometimes turn to my wife and go, my gosh, how do they write that? It's just so amazing how they can do that. And so hard, it takes so much time. And with feature films, it can take a lot of time too and a lot of rewriting, but you have so much more leeway because you're essentially trying to three-act story of the beginning, middle, and end, and so that you don't have everybody get to know who's who, what's going on, what's taking place, conflict, what happens in the middle, you know, some conclusion, some comes in the end, or some cliffhanger at the end of it seems like it's going to be in a series, going to be another film afterwards. So yeah, they're very different to write. A couple of scripts I've written, some producers said, oh, we should make that a series. And I said, you're welcome to, but I don't want to be the writer for it. you know, you can use, I'll be the writer for the main pilot for the first one that I wrote. But it's just so intense and so much, you know, ongoing.
Well, that's what head writers are for. I mean, once you've got a hit TV show or a show that, you know, somebody's willing to invest the money in to try to make it a hit, then you're going to have probably at least three, maybe four or five writers on your staff as well. So you don't always have to be the guy doing all the work. You get to be the guy sitting there letting them pitch the ideas to you. But again, that was a very strong point you made about that big picture, about the overall thing. I mean, you could be writing episode two of a series, and then the showrunner comes to you and says, oh, by the way, we've decided we're going to end the season a certain way. I need you to set this up in episode two. And it's like, well, I've already got everything in episode two. I don't have room to add anything else here, you know. And it's like, oh, no, we're going to have to introduce this character because by episode five, she's going to trick him, and by episode seven, she's going to try to kill him, you know. And so
I don't think I could. I don't think I could write that way. Yeah.
I'll stick to novels and short stories.
And you know, it's going to be the part. It's going to be the part that you like the most is what they want to take out almost always. I find that with like cover designing covers for these books and stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'll be working on one and there'll be some little thing about it that'll be my favorite part. I really like the way that title looks, or I really like how that worked or whatever. That's going to be the one the author didn't like.
I remember the first, for about 10 years ago, the first film that I had produced was something I'd written. they bought the rights to it. And then when I saw, then they got somebody else to come in and work on the script as well. And when it was done, and it was on Netflix, it was called Stellina Blue. And it was a completely different story. And they never worked with me on it at all after that, once they bought it. And it may be because I helped them, somebody I found was able to help put up some money for them to make the movie. And I have the feeling they had this other story in mind the whole time. And they just used my name as story by, but there's only one scene in the entire movie, which was one I wrote.
Back in the 80s, Stephen King's short story, The Lawnmower Man, was turned into a movie, and he said it had nothing to do with his story. So he actually went to court and forced them to take his name off of it, that they weren't going to sell it as a Stephen King story because it didn't resemble his story at all.
Yeah. Well, this I could not do anything like that. They, you know, I gave them total rights, and I learned from that since. So, you know, the last film I have produced, they worked really close with them, and they were fantastic. So, it's good and really important to have a good relationship, whether it's a publisher with your book and the cover, or whether it's a film and how you want that to come out. So,
I see over on Twitter, author Robert G. Willis-Croft, he says, just a short little comment, longhand, you and Longfellow.
Yeah.
My first novel was all in longhand. I wrote it by hand.
Well,
but I don't do that anymore.
Do it. Yeah.
I don't do it anymore, but.
Another thing about writing screenplays that you touched on there too is I just had a message come through. It's a more interactive process than being like a novelist. You know, with a novelist, yeah, you're going to have some interaction with your editor and whatnot, and then eventually with your publisher. But if you write a screenplay and it gets picked up, in some cases they'll blow you off. And it sounds, Gabriel, like maybe that kind of happened to you at least one time. But for the most part, they expect you to be participatory. They expect you to be able to answer that phone at 11 o'clock at night and say, by the way, this has just changed. We need some rewrites. We need this. We need this. Then all of a sudden the pressure gets heaped on you. And a lot of people, you know, like I've taught writing classes in prisons on a volunteer basis before. And a lot of those guys in there are thinking, well, I want to write screenplays. Well, you know, you can write while you're in prison, but you can't go to the meetings. You know, you can't participate in the script discussions, and you can't get with the director about the fact that he wants to change the setting from one place to another place or whatever. So if you can't really participate, it's hard to get into screenwriting. You're probably better off sticking with story writing and novels and things like that. But sounds like you've been around the track a few times with all of that too, Gabriel.
Yeah, that's really a good point. That's, it's very short story writing, novels, poetry. It's a very individual process, you know, and if you get if you start publishing it yourself or getting it through a traditional publisher, then you work with a publisher and editor from that respect, and they give ideas or suggestions or want you to work on things. But that's usually just a couple people. When it comes to a screenplay, writing it and getting the first thing, you know, the first draft and everything done until you get to the point where you feel like it's really working, and then the whole process of trying to find a producer, that's a whole process in itself, which we can talk about if you'd like to. But then if you are lucky enough to find somebody who wants to produce it and or direct it or put together a package and approach other people to provide the funding for it, then it becomes such a collaborative process. It's like a whole community of people. You're ending up when you start out as the producer, whoever puts up the money for it. That can be one, two, three, four executive producers.
And they will have opinions.
Two or three different producers, and they'll all say, oh, what about this? What about that? And you have the director come and say, oh, I think we should do this or that or change it, etc. And then you have all the casting director, and then you have the cast and who's in it and how they see it once they're on set. If they feel like things might work, then they talk to the director about maybe, you know, what do we think of this? And then they talk to you. And then when they're going through editing the film, they may say, oh, this doesn't work. What about this? And so the editor could get back to you. So it just becomes this ongoing, for it can be up to half a year to a year of collaboration with all these people before the film is actually ever done. And then whether it ever gets distributed is another story. And then whether it gets seen by anybody is another process. So in many ways, the odds of getting a script produced, picked up at first and then produced, and then getting a distributor and then having it seen, the odds are not in your favor.
Not at all.
It's probably 10 times more difficult than finding a publisher publishing, because it's also more financially, can go out and make your own movie, but it's not like self-publishing where you can go and self-publish it. It's so much more involved if you try to make your own film. And then to try to get it to any reputable distribution or picked up by anybody is almost impossible.
Yeah, I would think the distribution would be the hardest. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of distributors want to have the some production companies and distributors are now – some production companies have their own distribution or have agreements with distributors already. But most distributors want to either see the movie that's already completed. They want to say, oh, show us a clip from it. Is it all done? If it is done, then we'll give you these terms.
Yeah.
And we'll show it to, we'll sell it to these places. But yeah.
And we'd really like to see the audience give it a standing O at the film festival where you first air it.
Yeah. And that's the other thing about film festivals, and some really well-known film festivals can be really doors to getting it picked up for distribution. The competition is fierce, but not impossible. And you can do that. And you can go that route. And some producers will try that. And once they give it, gets some good publicity at some festival, then they'll present it to some distributors. And occasionally they'll pick that up. So I was talking to some producer yesterday. He said, a call with him, he said that films, you know, getting scripts and stories to scripts and to films, and he said, film industry, it's a business, but it's not like any other business there is. He said, because films, how if it gets made, it can get made in 100 different ways. in how it comes to be, and because there's so many varieties of way. You might know some relative who has money, will give you the money to get it made, and you get it made, and then nobody likes it, or it's horrible, nobody ever sees it. Or you can get crowdfunding for it, and you just get $100,000, and you get it made, and it gets really well accepted in a festival, and then a bunch of producers want to distribute it, and or you can just do it yourself and try to get it, you know, send it to film festivals online, which there's a lot of them now. Or you can try to get an agent and try to get them to present it to get one-on-one talks with people in the film industry who have a better chance of getting funding for it in the first place. So there's such a variety.
That one's a way better chance usually with the agent, because then the agent also has the contacts, knows who to call, knows what favors to call in and all that. And that's all the difference.
That's very true. But an agent is as hard to get as it is to find a producer.
Yep.
It's to get an agent that isn't just somebody who just wants you to pay money up front and not do anything and you never hear from them kind of thing. Somebody that really is connected, it's really hard to get. Again, not impossible, but just like you can find publishers and good publishers to do it yourself or et cetera. There are some good agents, but it's many times you need to get somebody to refer you to an agent that way. And one nice thing about shows like this and, you know, the writing community online on Twitter and a number of places, there's much more community now of social networks. There's Stage 32, there's Inktip, there's all these different places where you can meet with other writers and screenwriters and producers and directors and agents and pitch your story and stuff and try to find agents through that route. So it's much more accessible than it ever used to be. In the past, you essentially, if you wanted to get an agent or to get your movie produced or seen by anybody, you literally had to go in person and meet the person in Los Angeles. And that was pretty much it. And now there's huge film industries in a lot of places, in Atlanta. Starting to be a pretty big one in Nashville, in Vancouver, Canada, in LA, and
Orlando.
With the technology now. Orlando, yep, and with the technology now, and a lot of places overseas in different places. Now with technology now, you can have meetings with people via Zoom and other places, and you don't have to meet in person. So it's like you were saying earlier, there's in a lot of ways there's so many more avenues now. And even though it's difficult to get a movie made or book published, there's also so many more channels and so much more content needed. There's hundreds and hundreds of streaming services now looking for content. But again, it has to be something that's well done and good, because most of them won't just put up anything just because you say, oh, here, and then they'll put it up. So.
Yeah, now one big evolution in the agenting business that's happened in publishing in the past 10 or 15 years, which I assume is probably happening in the film and television industry too, is used to be that you could approach an agent and you were trying to pitch yourself, your capabilities, your future potential, and to get that agent to believe in you. And usually you're showing, you know, a sample of your work. Here's the book that I wrote or whatever. And now in the publishing industry, it has gotten to the point to where an agent will not even talk to you unless you've got a track record. Show me that you self-published that book or went with an indie publisher and sold 10,000 copies and built your following to 100,000 followers. Then we'll talk about me being your agent, because that agent has to then go to publishers, acquisition editors, and various people. And that's one of the first questions that agent's going to be asked. Well, what kind of track record this person got? Has he got a platform? Has he got something he can stand on that people will pay attention to him? Or is this a nobody that nobody has ever heard of? And I suspect that in film and television, it's getting that way more and more too, that you better have some track record if you want to get somebody's attention.
That's true. And it's very much like the chicken and the egg. You know, it's the same with publishing and with getting scripts accepted or finding an agent. They'll want, well, where are things published? But, you know, where's your stuff published? And well, if you publish me, I'll have something published.
Yeah.
and the other way around, you know, and it's the same with, do you have any well-known actor attached to it? No. You try to contact an actor, a well-known actor. Well, do you have a producer, somebody can finance it yet? Well, once you do, then we'll attach ourselves to it. And you say, no, we don't have the funding yet. Okay, well, get in touch with me on funding. You try to get executive producers and try to get funding. They say, well, do you have anybody, a listing actors attached to it? No, but well, once you do, let us know. So it's, you know, it's very similar, as you were saying, with agents and publishing books, although I think it's much more easier. And just all the difference now in postage and waiting times is so, I remember 10, 15, 20 years ago, I spent so much money on postage and return postage, sending out stories or scripts to agents or to produce or to publishers, saying, oh, look at this. This is what I've done. I'm hoping for sending the first two or three chapters, and then waiting months and months and months and 5, 6 months and not hearing anything, sending them another letter, and then finally getting, you know, saying, no, we aren't interested, or, you know, 49 out of 50 would say, no, we're interested. Or one finally saying, yeah, why don't you send us the rest of it? And then printing out the whole book and sending it and then waiting another 4 or 5 months to hear from them again. So that's so much faster now.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Cheaper. So, yeah.
Well, now you just referred to when they attach themselves to a project, and that's a term that people hear a lot. There's a couple of other terms that basically mean the same thing, but basically what you're talking about there is a kind of a handshake agreement, like, okay, you can use our name. You can say that we're attached to this project as you go out and start putting the other pieces together. But a lot of people, particular newbies, you know, they'll get, it'll look like a screenplay is going to be picked up or there might be a deal in the works or whatever. And they think, okay, it's a done deal. Everything's ready to go. And I would bet that probably 95% of those attachments wind up eventually falling apart as deals don't actually come together. Would you say that's true?
I don't know. I don't know statistically how much of that's true. I do know that happens a lot, though.
A lot.
That's really true. A lot, yeah. And there's a script I wrote called Spy Another Day. It's a romantic comedy about these two retired spies that used to be against each other. She is from a foreign country as an agent. He is from like 007 kind of person. And I was trying to get Pierce Brosnan and some other, and Isabella Rossellini to get attached to play in it. And it was just, I kept contacting their agents and I kept, once you get, the money and, $1 zillion, then we'll look at the script, And then I contact producers and say, I'd like to get, I never said to either of them, though, that it was a done deal, because it wasn't. So, but until it was a done deal and anything was signed, I couldn't really say that. So that never happened. I'm still trying to get that script produced, but that does happen quite a bit. So.
Well, before we play your trailer for The Last Conception, why don't you go ahead and tell us how to find a producer? You mentioned that earlier. What advice would you give writers who are looking for a producer so they can try to get a screenplay project going?
There's a couple of ways that I've discovered over the last, I've been writing screenplays around 12 years, not a long time, about 12 years, 12, 14 years, and I've keep getting better the more I do. It's really different than writing novels or short stories. It's really different. When you talk about show don't tell, this is show don't tell times 10 to write a script. But so I learned a lot about the first one I wrote I thought was so good. Look back on it now, it was horrible. No wonder nobody picked it up. But the ways I found to contact producers or agents for scripts is, one, going through IMDb. It stands for Internet Movie Database. And it has every film you can probably ever think of is all listed on there, every actor, producer, and everybody is on there, and they have their most recent movies they've done before, et cetera, the kinds of movies they've done, what movies they've been in, if they're an editor, what movies they edited, if they're a cinematographer, what cinematography they've had. And you can join this thing, I think it's called IMDb Pro. And with that, then you get more than just the basic information. You can go on there just to look up stuff about a movie. Oh, that actor looks familiar. I wonder, weren't they in that other movie? And you can look up on there and just see what all the movies they were in on just the regular IMDb.
I use that often.
But with IMDb Pro, you can go on and you can get a little more details. Sometimes you can get a lot of contact information. So what I've done over the years, I've gone, if I have a script I'm trying to get a producer to look at, I will go through a lot of producers, literally hundreds and hundreds, and see if they have any contact information available. If they do, then I'll look and see what kinds of films they've done, whether they're mostly comedy, mostly drama, mostly romantic comedies, horror movies, thrillers, action movies, animation, family movies, whatever the sort of genre is or mixture of that. Or sometimes they've done a variety of things, and see if they have the contact information, usually email. I knew you'd never want to call them just out of the blue. That will never work.
Never.
So they have it. Never. So if you have an email, their phone number, write it down, but don't ever call them. Just an email, and then the same thing with this other online network called Stage 32. You can go and join that. That doesn't cost anything. And you can connect with other writers, screenwriters, sometimes producers, and it's sort of like Facebook or Twitter. You can follow them, they follow you, et cetera. And then many of them will post the kind of things they have or they're looking for certain things. And then there's this other thing called Inktip. And that's something you could cost, how much I think it's raised. It's around $40 every 3 months. So it's rather expensive. But what they do is they give you every week, anywhere from 6 to 8, they're in contact with different producers and executive producers that are looking for specific kinds of scripts. And so they put up what kind of script the person is looking for and that the person is looking for that kind of script now. And they send it out in this newsletter called Inktip Newsletter to people that are signed up as members of this. And then then you go through Inktip and you provide your query. You provide any personal stuff. You provide a log line, which is a one sentence that describes your movie, your script. And then you put a synopsis. And then you put down anything you've had produced before, anything related at all to film in any way. And that's the same thing you would do with the other places. If you want to query somebody for a screenplay, it's very similar to querying somebody for a book or a short story collection or short stories. You want to first start out with like a one line, like a pitch line, and then have a brief synopsis of what it is. And I mean brief, like 4 or 5 sentence synopsis, maybe 6 sentences. And then a brief, you know, three sentences of what you've had published or not published, or not what you haven't done, anything you've had published in any means, any presence you have on the internet, any platforms you have, any networks you have, anybody maybe you know that's connected to other people that has a lot of followers, et cetera. And then you send the query letter to them with your contact information. And then usually for me, I wait 2-3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, and I haven't heard anything, then I contact them again. So, and I keep doing that for up to about 6 months. And it's surprising how many people, especially with producers, the first 2 times and never hear from them, the 3rd time they'll act like they never heard of me. And, oh, yeah, why don't you send that over? We'll take a look at it. So, and with publishers, as you're aware very well, some will just want to query, and then if they're interested at all, some will just ask for the first chapter. So if they just ask for that, don't send the whole thing, just ask for that. And then other agents or publishers will ask, so yeah, you send me the whole manuscript. So. So those are the 3 ways I have found most effective, is through those things. And then just people I connect with on all the different social networks, and some's a producer, or they are connected to somebody, and I'll say, oh, do you think they'd be open to et cetera, et cetera. So.
Well, over on Twitter, Robert Willis-Croft is asking you, can a person shop a novel for a movie instead of shopping a script?
That can happen, but I'm not sure. Two of my scripts are based on novels. They're based on, actually 4 of my scripts are based on novels. 2 are based on other people's novels. 1 that just got picked up this week is one of those. It's based on somebody else's novel. But then I wrote the script based on the novel with that person's permission. And then the other 2 are from books I wrote. So that's where the screenplay was already done. I do know that some people get novels picked up occasionally, but I've only heard of that happening through an agent. And only through agents, and only through books that have become well known in some way, or have a really large circulation of sales, number of sales. And that's the only, I don't know, but I'm sure it is possible to contact people directly, but most producers, and I can't think of any that I know of, any films I know of, that were made just straight without an agent, straight from the novelist to a producer. Although David Pertmiller, now that I think of it, I don't know how he got his mate. He had a number of books in, and I think...
Wrong Way, Wrong
the
Turn?
Gentleman. Yeah. And I think he's having a... I think they're in the process of making the film, or it's just about done, of one of his books. That one. And I'm not sure how he... if he got approached or was approached by somebody... So they could connect with him to ask him that. But that's the only one that I've heard of that may have been just directly.
Yeah, I think one of the big barriers to trying to do it that way would be the simple fact that you can have a great novel and a lousy screenplay from the same story. The screenplay
Absolutely.
Writer has to be a very skilled storyteller who also knows how to work within that format. So what you're trying to sell, if all you have is a novel, is the possibility that this could be a great screenplay. Whereas if you've got a great screenplay, then you're selling the real thing. And that's a big step forward from trying to talk about what could be someday, especially if you don't have the track record. Now, if you're shopping your novel and it's like also attached to this is, so-and-so great screenwriter who did this movie, that movie, and those two movies over there, and he has the track record to prove he knows what he's doing, now you've got something that you're trying to sell. As opposed
Absolutely.
To just possibilities.
If you said this person has read this and would love to write the screenplay for this, that's true.
Yeah, that might be all it takes if that person has the reputation.
Yeah.
All right, so Beam, let's start talking about Gabriel's work here. You want to go ahead and read the blurb for The Last Conception, and then we'll play the trailer. And listeners, keep in mind, this is just a regular movie trailer. It's not a voiceover, so you're going to hear characters talking, but not actually be able to see them. So it's not quite exactly a radio commercial, but we wanted to give you a flavor of what the movie's about. So this is The Last Conception. Beam?
Yeah, and the blurb reads as, passionate embryologist Savarna is in a complicated relationship with two different women when she is told that she must have a baby. Her conservative East Indian American parents are desperate for her to conceive of her not being married. They insist that she is the last in line of a great spiritual lineage. In the process of choosing her lover and having doubts about her ability or desire to conceive, Savarna begins to question the necessity of biology and lineage within her parents' beliefs and becomes forever fascinated with the process of conception and the definition of family. Threads of Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, Chitra Banerjee, here's these words, Devakaruni, Sister of My Heart, and The L Word TV series, flavor this colorful tale of awakening, romance, and mystery. And that is called The Last Conception. And the trailer is on YouTube, so you can go over there and check that out.
Yep, go ahead and play.
All righty.
What?
You're 30, fam.
What do you mean, so? We're getting old, okay? No 30-year-old woman just brings a friend to dinner. They're gonna know.
Okay.
Don't be cool with it. Come on.
You don't know Indian parents. It's not gonna be as easy as you think. You are serious with this guy?
I expect you'll be phoning your mother tomorrow morning as well. But Grim's dead.
Not that one. We have something to tell you all. We are Buddhists.
You are direct descendants of Buddha, the last one.
And your grandma's here to make sure that you get pregnant, Savarna. To ensure that the bloodline continues. Shh, I think she's coming. Act normal.
Ma!
Brace yourself.
Having a good time, I hope.
I can make my own decisions. I'm a grown woman. Don't tell your father.
Well, let me put it this way. If anyone in the modern world were related to Jesus, this would be the best type of proof you could ask for.
Do Savarna and I have any...
powers.
I thought that's why we were all here, to see if we have Buddha's superpowers.
I can keep secrets.
My mom's gonna hate that.
You think we were joking? Babe, you are the only one freaking out.
You even like babies?
Oh, no, I mean, my sister's baby smells good. Does that count?
So, how long have you been gay?
And there you go. Now, I watched the movie, and I enjoyed it. It was it's a romantic comedy. It's got a lot of, you know, funny moments in it, and I'm a fan of Matt Richards, which surprised me to see him there in the opening. I've been watching him and participating in his HQ game show for a few years now, as has Steven.
So, yeah, get over there to YouTube and watch that trailer, because it does work a lot better if you can see what's happening while you're hearing it as well. But that's The Last Conception, and you should be able to find it either under that name or if you look up Gabriel Constance. So, Gabriel, did you have fun working on this? How did it happen? What kind of stories can you tell?
it was great. And it's interesting because the book that I wrote is very it's more just a dramatic romance. And then when the director and producer, Gabriel Ladisima, the director, and Kali Shutera, the other producer, who is also co-stars in the film, with Nazanin Mandi, who's also a really well-known model and actress married to Miguel, famous Grammy-winning musician and singer, they changed it as they were going along and made it into a romantic comedy. And they did it by changing a lot of the dialogue, which I had originally written a screenplay, but they consulted with me the whole way, and they did a wonderful job. I thought they made it so much better as a movie. And it came, I think it turned out really well. I was really happy with it. And it's gotten a lot of great feedback and reviews, and it's available a lot of places. We're trying to get the distributor is trying to get picked up by Netflix and Hulu right now, and hopefully that will happen in sometime soon, and also overseas. There's a number of countries that we hope to have it available as well. Right now it's just in the U.S. and Canada. So.
Now tell our listeners where they can actually view this. And then they can write a review for it as well, because that'll help out.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, Amazon Prime is that's one. If you have Amazon Prime membership, it's free. Or you can watch it if you don't, with I think commercials, or you can rent it. It's also on iTunes. It's also on YouTube. You can watch the whole film on there. It's also on Fandango. It's also on Vudu. It's also on Rogers Cable in Canada. It's also on DirecTV in Canada. It's also on a network called Wild TV, WILDE. And I'm probably forgetting a couple of other places. It's on three or four other places as well. So,
yep. Spread the word, people, and definitely post those reviews. Now, what's the status of your Cry of the Sea screenplay?
That is the one that just was talking to the producer last week. We had this long phone conversation, and they're going to they're writing up the contract for me right now. So I hope to get that soon, and they're going to be putting together a package and approaching a number of people at some very well-known studios that they think would be interested in producing this. So that's very, very exciting. And I'm waiting to let the book know about definitely happening until I get the contract. So there's another book, the other book I wrote, and a screenplay for that called Elizabeth's Landing. It's a great book, and I think a really good screenplay, but I'm still trying to work on finding a producer for that. And about this woman and this coming-of-age story, this 16-year-old goes to a small town in southern Texas. Her family moves there, and she finds this turtle on the shoreline and tries to protect it, and all these people wanting to get rid of the build on the land there. She tries to fight that with her family, and so it's sort of an environmental coming of age story, and it's really good. And Cry of the Sea is a similar story, but it's about sea life and mermaids and an Indian American environmental family in the Pacific Northwest. So,
okay. Now, we want to urge our listeners, get over there to wherever your favorite retailer is. Look up Gabriel Constance. He's got other books for sale, Buddha's Wife, St. Catherine's Baby, The Skin of Lions. Here's my favorite title, Zen Master Tova Tarantino Toshiba, The Illustrious and Delusional Abbess of Satire. But anyway, there's a lot of good stuff over there. We don't have time to get into all of them right now, but go check it out. Get your copies. Make sure you leave good reviews for stuff and help spread the word. So, Gabriel, how do people find you? How do they contact you? What's your handles out there on social media? Are you on Instagram, Facebook?
I'm on Facebook, and I believe it's just under Gabriel Constance, GabrielConstans. And it's same on Twitter. It's at Gabriel Constance. I believe it's the same on Instagram. I never go on Instagram, so I don't pay much attention there other than Nazanin and Miguel are both on Instagram and have millions of followers. So they talk about the movie that she's in on there, which is great. But other than that, I haven't gone on there much. I'm on LinkedIn as well, under Gabriel Constance. I don't have any other names, so it's pretty easy if you spell my name right to find me. I also have a website, just gogabriel.com. And I believe my email is on the about page, if I recall. But through Twitter, you can send me a message through Twitter. I'm on there pretty much every day, connecting with other writers and screenwriters and artists and different people. And that's it. You can just try to contact me through the air, ether in the ether, and send good vibes and energy and, you know, and I'll maybe pick it up on my ukulele strings.
Yeah. And if people want to get a hold of you also, and they didn't catch any of that, they can always go to the Fresh Ink Group website, freshinkgroup.com, and use the contact form and say, hey, I want to send a message to Gabriel, who was on your show the other night or whatever. So there's another way to contact you, and we can just forward that to you.
Okay. And listeners, if you came in late and want to hear the rest of this show, or you want to tell others about it, you can go to our archives, go over to our YouTube channel at Fresh Ink Group, and look for all of our podcasts there. You can go to three of our websites, freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. And all three of those websites have a tab called podcasts. And you know what's under that tab? I'm not going to tell you. I'll let you figure that out yourself. But we also are on Spotify now. So get over there and check out these episodes. And help spread the word about Gabriel's appearance tonight, because not only is he a great writer and screenplay writer who has a lot of interesting things to tell, but he also had a lot of good advice for writers who are looking to expand and get more into movies and television, too.
Indeed. And also, listeners, be sure to get over to the Fresh Ink Group website, freshinkgroup.com, and scroll to the bottom of the page and find that newsletter and subscribe to it.
Yeah, definitely.
You'll be in the know for everything. Well,
okay,
we are about out of time.
Next week, David Carroll talking about Hello Chattanooga. And thanks, Gabriel. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah. This was a really fun show.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll talk again soon, Gabe.
Yeah, maybe we can do this again. So, again, listeners, David Carroll next week, and everybody have a safe and wonderful rest of your week and weekend, and we will see you back here again next Wednesday.
Yep.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com, and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.